Good evening. On behalf of all the geologists in the audience, I'm sure you share our excitement that so many of you have joined us. Thank you very, very much. My name is Carrie Hegarty, and I'm chairman of the Geological Society of Australia here in Victoria. And we welcome you to the 1998 Selwyn Memorial Presentation and Lecture. This is the 15th Selwyn presentation, and it's one of the premier events on our GSA calendar. So thank you very much for coming and joining us this evening. The Geological Society of Australia is a nationwide organization. It's an organization that most members would have joined as a student geologist, been involved in as a practicing geological researcher or mining geologist, and continued their membership perhaps into their retirement. It is broad-reaching, serious, and involves people who are passionate about their work. It is this passion and interest that underlies the activities of the GSA. The second part of the proceedings is the Selwyn Lecture. This is provided by our invited guest speaker, Dr. Matthew Gollombeck, geologist extraordinaire and project scientist for the whole of the Mars Pathfinder mission. Matt will be happy to take a few questions, always a popular segment of his lectures, following his lectures. And there are microphones placed here and one slightly further back. So when that period of the program commences, you could queue up if you'd like to ask a question. We have a simple purpose, and that is to tell you about the excitement of science and the excitement of the geological sciences. We are thrilled to see such a strong response tonight, and we thank our sponsors. On to the Selwyn Lecture. I would like to introduce Dr. Matt Gollombeck. As the Mars Pathfinder Project scientist, Dr. Gollombeck was responsible for the overall scientific content of the mission to Mars, and he was the prime interface between the project, the science community, and NASA headquarters. He chaired the project. He oversaw 70 geoscientists, was deputy of the experiment operations team, was a member of the management group that provided input to the budget and management decisions, and most importantly, Matt is a geologist. Like most geologists, Matt enjoys a nice beer and a good pizza. He's very friendly, he's very outgoing, and he speaks passionately about his topic. Matt has flown here for the express purpose to talk to you here at the Melbourne Town Hall, at the request of the Geological Society. So I take great pleasure in the fact that he accepted our invitation and that he speaks to you tonight. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much. It truly is a pleasure to be here. Those of you have probably heard of the Pathfinder mission. It's what NASA would call a Discovery class mission. That's a mission that has three basic pieces to it. It's faster, it's cheaper, and it's better. Okay, faster, cheaper, better. Well, we can measure those. Faster, it took us 3.5 years to design the spacecraft and place it on top of the launch vehicle and fire it off to Mars. And for those of you familiar with space missions in general, that can take up to 10 years, which is, of course, much, much longer. Now, cheaper, we can measure that, too. I happen to be from Los Angeles, and we tend to measure costs in major motion picture space. And so in that kind of environment, Pathfinder costs less than the movie Waterworld that you all did not see. Now, for those of you that don't know what Waterworld cost, about $250 million U.S., and that's the cost for the entire spacecraft, the rocket, the operations, all the people, everything. So that's not a lot of money. For reference, the last mission that went to Mars 20 years ago cost about $3.5 billion, roughly 20 times more than that. Okay, so it's faster, it's cheaper, and is it better? Well, how do you measure better? You need some benchmark to do that. You could say, well, we got front page headlines for the first week of the mission. That was better. You could say, we're the largest internet event in world history at the time of landing. In the first month of operations, we received 566 million web hits on our system of computers, and that was by far and away the largest of any such event in history. And interestingly enough, on July 8th, 4 days after landing, we received 47 million web hits. That's a lot of hits. Imagine just $1 for each of those. Okay, well, that's kind of better. How about we set all land and speed records on Mars with our rover? That's better, right? Don't like that either, huh? Well, I like to measure better, being a scientist, by what you've got after you're all done. You've done the mission, all the hubbub is over. What have you left with? What have you learned? What's fundamentally important from the mission? And I like to tell one story that sort of epitomizes that. Imagine if you could learn something fundamental about Mars without sending an instrument to measure it. You just kind of got it for free because you were there. If, in effect, sort of a serendipitous discovery. And Pathfinder did that, in fact. We were able to track the location of the spacecraft on the surface of Mars quite precisely, and in fact determine its location to within about 100 meters. And during this activity of tracking it, we actually could see the spacecraft rotate in space as Mars spun around on its axis. Mars is a spinner. It spins in 24 hours and 37 minutes. Now, the apex, or the point of that small circle, is in fact the pole of rotation of the planet. And the last time that this measurement was done was 20 years ago, and that pole has precessed around in space, just as if you were to take a top and spin it and watch the top of the top rotate around. That tells you something fundamental about Mars. It allows you to calculate a number called the moment of inertia, which to first order tells you the density distribution within the planet. So simply by tracking Pathfinder on the surface of Mars, we now know that Mars has a central metallic core that must have a radius of at least 1,300 kilometers, but can't be too much bigger than 2,400 kilometers. So kind of for free, if you will. So I really call that better. You all should feel wonder in your hearts when you look at that surface for the first time. Because if you think about it, it's an event that you shared with the rest of the world. And in my lifetime, there's only been 5 or 6 such events that I can recall where the whole world looked at one thing at one time and said, wow. And if you were to push me about what the real value of the space program was, I would say it has the power to bring the world together, even if only for a moment, and only done for good. There was nothing, it was done to explore Mars. It was not a negative event. This is what the Pathfinder landing site would look like if you were to stand at the lander and pivot around in a clockwise sense. You can see the rear ramp that we used to come down off the lander, a couple of pirouettes, and there's the rover against the rock named Yogi. You can see the airbags sort of billowed out around the one of the lander pedals shown here. You see a... Yes, absolutely. You see a rocky surface, sort of dusty, kind of rusty red in color, if you will, pretty similar to the outback of Australia. Again, the billowy airbags here, chatter marks where the airbags were retracted in around the lander, the second of the 3 pedals that opened up, a 1-meter-high meteorology mast for measuring the weather on Mars, a low-gain antenna as a backup capable of hundreds of bits per second direct-to-Earth return. The forward ramp, you can see, is in fact did not deploy down to the surface. It's really a diving board, and so we were forced to go off the rear ramp. There you can see the area of our prime science interest, the so-called rock garden, large rocks, not very dust-covered, and ones we wanted to measure with our rover. The beautiful streamlined islands in the background, large perched rock sitting on the surface, and back around to the rover sitting at Yogi. You can see how the color of the soil has gotten darker and deeper red, where in fact the rover tracks have gone across the surface. And we believe that's due to this light wind-blown dust being disturbed by the rover wheels and pulling up the underlying deeper red material beneath it. This is our little payload. This is the Sojourner rover. It's about the size of your laser printer or your microwave oven. It's a six-wheel drive beastie. Each wheel has a motor in it. Oop, first fender bender on Mars right there. It's really tough to drive when you're a couple of 100 million miles away from your target. There we get the APX right up against Yogi. Has a solar panel on top for power, a UHF antenna right there for returning data to the lander. All data goes from the rover to the lander to the Earth. Commands go from the Earth to the lander to the rover. On the back is an alpha proton X-ray spectrometer. Oh, there we are digging a hole to learn about the material properties of the soil. You can see the outer four wheels turn so that this vehicle can, in fact, turn in place or even crab sideways if need be. Here you'll see the alpha proton X-ray spectrometer being lowered down against the rock called Scooby-Doo. And this allows you to measure the chemical composition of whatever's in that material, of everything down to a fraction of a percent except helium and hydrogen. You can see we're using the cleats of the rover wheels to try to scuff up Scooby-Doo. And as you can see, we are unsuccessful in this attempt, showing that Scooby-Doo is an indurated or cemented material, and thus maybe some sort of a cemented soil, if you will. Now, if you think about it, there's a 10-minute one-way light time delay between Earth and Mars. So you cannot joystick this rover in any way similar to the way you joystick a small remote control car or toy here on the Earth. By the time you realized what it had gone over, it'd be gone. It would have fallen over the cliff. So you can't do that. Oop, first wheelie on Mars right there. You have to give the rover some smarts, and it has a series of laser light stripers, and here you see it using those laser light stripers to center in on the rock called Soufflé. That was my favorite command that we could send to the rover, the so-called find rock command. Now, these laser light stripers actually determine the size of obstacles in front of the rover, and if they're too big to go over, it will automatically avoid them. Tremendous mobility. You've seen the rover go over a rock, a full wheel diameter and height. For reference, that would be like driving over your kitchen table with your car, which I would not recommend you trying. The rover has these laser light stripers, potentiometers on the bogies, and it moves very, very slowly and keeps itself in a stable configuration. The wind socks showing the amount of wind at three levels on the surface of Mars to determine something about the aerodynamic roughness. The spacecraft is shown here. This is the view we never, ever wanted to see, the so-called exploded view. Here's the cruise stage. It's a backpack-style cruise stage with four propulsion tanks and thruster clusters, a back shell, three small solid rockets, and a parachute. A tetrahedral-shaped lander with four triangle panels, three of them hinged to the base plate here. One central computer in the center of the lander that controls the spacecraft from cruise, entry, descent, landing, and surface operations. So this is a novel spacecraft design. There was not a separate cruise phase that actually took you there. And a heat shield that allows you to enter the atmosphere directly. This is all buttoned up. We launched on December 4th, 1996. It took us 7 months. That was actually 2 months quicker than usual to get to Mars. And we arrived at Mars on July 4th, 1997, which does have some significance in the U.S. Here we are, arriving about a half an hour before arrival. We jettison that cruise stage. We don't need it anymore. We enter the atmosphere directly behind the aeroshell. We could not go into orbit, no way. We then have about 4 minutes to go from 35,000 kilometers per hour to full dead stop, dangling 10 meters above the surface. And in that time, roughly 50 to 75 absolutely critical events must occur for this thing to survive. Let's go through them. We enter the atmosphere directly. We use the friction of the atmosphere to slow us down in a fiery ball. The parachute pops out. The aeroshell dumps off. The lander is deployed down a 20-meter tether or bridle. A radar altimeter measures the closing velocity with the surface. The airbags are inflated. And when the airbags are inflated, they would pretty much fill this auditorium. That's how large they are. The solid rocket's fire brings the whole stack to zero kilometers per second vertical. The tether is cut. Those solid rockets continue to fire and take the parachute away. You certainly wouldn't want it to land on top of you. And then you bounce. First bounce was 40 meters high, well over this building. And we bounced 15 to 20 times on the surface of Mars without a single puncture in the airbags. After coming to rest, the accelerometers determine the spacecraft is stationary. It uninflates the airbags. It retracts the airbags. It determines which face of the lander is down, and it opens up in the proper configuration to give an upright and operational lander roughly 1 hour and a half later. So every time I showed this slide prior to landing, pretty much in the U.S., everyone said, "You guys are nuts. This will never work. It's way too complicated. You're wasting U.S. taxpayers' dollars, and you're all on drugs." And I can say without question that none of those were the case. We tested every subsystem of this landing sequence to excruciating detail. The engineers had so much fun with this mission because they got to throw things out of airplanes at high levels and watch what happens to them as they come down. The proof, of course, is in the pudding. We landed safely on Mars, and so it worked.